Welcome to the Horror Writers Podcast. Join Jay Thorne and Richard Brown as they discuss writing and publishing horror using strategies that work for all genres.
Hey everyone, to episode 10 of the Horror Writers Podcast. I'm Jay Thorne with my co-host, Richard Brown. Say hi, Richard. Don't.
Hey, Richard.
Oh, I was okay. Yeah, I'm here.
All right. And also, we also have a guest with us tonight, author Scott Nicholson.
Hi, guys. Good to be here.
All right.
Good to get some FaceTime.
Yeah. We haven't, the three of us haven't met face to face, virtually or in real life. So this is pretty exciting stuff for us. We are really excited to have Scott on tonight and talking about things related to horror and writing and all kind of great stuff. And like we do with every show, we thought we'd just kind of start with what's new with everyone. So Richard said he doesn't have anything to share at all, but I'm sure he's going to make something up now. What's new, Richard?
Geez, put me on the spot. My comic should be out now, so the comic I did with my wife. Other than that, nothing really going on. It's been kind of a slow week for me. So cool. Yeah, when I said I didn't have anything, I really meant that.
You really meant it.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm sure you guys will make up for it though.
What do you got going on this week, Scott? Anything interesting, exciting?
Now I'm working on the fourth book in my after post-apocalyptic series, and I got that up for pre-order in early November, so it's kind of weird to have something I'm already marketing and selling and don't know if I'll finish. Well, I've got to finish. I don't have a choice, so yeah.
You will
it's
now.
Kind of all-consuming.
Are you getting a lot of pre-orders?
Pretty decently, yeah, but I haven't really been marketing it. I just think people who've already got the earlier books in the series are kind of discovering it. That was kind of the purpose of it for me, is to go ahead and have it out there, because people that just read the third book, they have nothing to do but wait, and then it's right. Hard to find someone later on, you know. It's like you have to find somebody every time you put a new book out.
Go ahead.
No, I just figured it's this way people could be finding it during the time I wrote it over 2 months. So hopefully it'll work out. And this seems to be working. And then I'll save most of my marketing till it's actually out. So right now it's just everything's bonus. I'm not really pushing it really hard yet. Most people don't even know about it.
Yeah, there seems to be a debate about whether or not to do the pre-order thing, because – you know, it affects your ranking. You don't get that big push right when it comes out, because you get the sales kind of spread out over the pre-order, time. And yeah, so I know a lot of people, they're not sure whether or not that's a good idea. But at the same time, like you said, if somebody gets finished reading maybe your third book, well, then they got immediately somewhere where they can go, where they can buy, already set their money down for that fourth one. So mm-hmm. It's kind of, it's hard to say.
I think it depends on the circumstances. A series seems to make more sense than a book that you're trying to push hard out of the gate, because I did one in like January that Amazon set up for me, and I wasn't that crazy about the results because of what you said. You kind of dilute the original push out that you get from the algorithms or whatever. So I did it for a series. I don't know if I'll do it for any more books, but again, it's a case by case thing with me. I'm not going to make it a habit.
So you're like, you put it for pre-order, but you're not mentioning it to your mailing list or doing anything like that?
No, I'll wait till it's new.
Okay, yeah. That's what I figured too. Like, put it out there, that way anybody who is reading the series, who gets to that third book, maybe they'll go buy it,
right,
the next one. But don't really push it out, don't really promote it, and that way you still get a push from your list and stuff when it finally comes out.
Right. And I want to keep people interested, because, these days, if you don't publish a book every month, yeah, they're publishing 3,000 books every day, so you got to stay afloat somehow.
And I feel so slow, like, compared to most authors, because, like, people just really, like, they're getting a book out, like, all the time, and I'm just, what happened to, you know, two or three a year?
Well, it's great for the readers who love to read, you know, if they have a favorite authors, or, and they have a lot more choices, so I'm really happy for readers. You know, it's going to get tough for writers, but who cares about writers, you know?
We're already getting into the doomsday stuff.
Thought we weren't going to go there.
Well,
I can't resist.
You took us there, yeah.
Well, I'm going to talk about doomsday a little bit later in a different context. So maybe we should save that. But I did promise Richard last podcast I would give a quick report back on Author Marketing Live, which was this past Monday. Jim Kukral put that on, and it was really, really an incredible day. It was a great opportunity for me to meet a lot of great writers and aspiring writers, and I was extremely nervous, but I'm glad I did it. So just wanted to say that was a success. I came back in one piece, and I'm back. So
you said you weren't going to be nervous.
I said,
like,
I was gonna be a little
bit
nervous.
Story. I know my story, so I'm just going to tell my story, and it's no big deal.
But I'm not used to telling my story in front of 150 strangers. That's the difference.
They said your speech was like one of the best ones, though.
Yeah, I don't know who they are, but they don't know what they're talking about.
Well, Jim said it, and I've seen a few people who left reviews who said that your speech was really good.
It was fun. It was fun, definitely. And, you know, I'll probably do it again at some point somewhere, but that was my first real public speaking opportunity as an author, and so I was pretty pleased with it, and it was really cool to hang out with Brian Cohen and Jim from the Sell More Books show, and I got to talk to Johnny and Sean from Self-Publishing Podcast and kind of figure out, you know, ask them what they were up to. So it was a good time. There were a lot of great people there.
Yeah, Cleveland's just a little too far for me, but maybe if he could do like 3 or 4 a year and then have them kind of spread out across the country, then maybe I could make it to one, but...
Well, Jim's talking about doing another one and moving it to a different city next year. So, yeah, we'll see.
Cool.
But I was wondering, you know, what the weather is like in Boone this time of the year, Scott. What's it like where you are?
It's actually chilly right now, yeah. But, yeah, I'm a big gardener, you know, organic gardener, so I've been canning a lot. And got the garden's actually about done. So still got some potatoes and squash and a little bit of corn, but yeah, I've been canning like it's doomsday's coming.
Well, it is coming, right?
Well, eventually, I mean, sooner or later.
How big is your underground bunker?
Yeah, I don't actually have a bunker. I'm actually not a fatalist. I don't want to live in that kind of world. I'm not a survivalist. I'm just a independent. I just want to be independent, you know. I don't want to live in a world where we're all holed up shooting each other and hoarding gold and stuff. I don't see the point of that kind of life.
You don't want to live in the world that you write.
Yeah, exactly. It's fantasy. I mean, just think, who's going to win that war? The worst people, you know. Who's going to win in that world? And who's going to want to live with those worst people?
Yeah. Well, tell me about your vegetables. I mean, I know enough about backyard gardening to be slightly dangerous. You know, how many beds do you have? Like, what, you know, how do you rotate? What's sort of your go-to crop?
Well, I like tomatoes, but the Appalachian Mountains where we are is a deciduous rainforest, so it's really rainy. It's surprisingly, it's sort of like it is a rainforest. We just have oak trees instead of, like, palm trees or jungle. I'm a seed saver. I just like kind of the cultural part of getting local seeds that have been around here for a long time and keeping them going. And, you know, with the genetic concerns, genetically modified food, we don't know when those crops will fail. It seems like I think we're rolling the dice on a lot of this stuff we're doing, and we don't know the outcome because we haven't had – they test something in a lab for 2 years and then think, okay, it's fine, but we don't know the long-term effects of these things. So, some of these strains may start dying out that have been modified, and then we're going to need food to replace it. I was just reading an article. How come there's only 5 apples in the grocery store when there's hundreds of different varieties across this country? And it may be that those 5, you know, take over because people stop, the other ones die out, and then we've got these 5 that have been manufactured, and we don't know their fate. You know, I tend to trust nature that's been around tens of thousands, of hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years, instead of some scientist who made something up a couple of years ago and patented it, so they've got the copyright on this food. Don't trust that.
So what do you think about the, there's a lot of studies that have been coming out saying, like, organic foods are basically a sham, right? Like, that they're, and I'll full disclosure, like, we buy organic produce, so I'm a consumer of organic produce. But there are a lot of these studies coming out saying, like, it's a waste of money. People are paying two or three times more for organic produce, and there really aren't any proven benefits.
Well, I think they're making the wrong comparison, because they compare nutritional value, which is the wrong answer. The thing to look for is the poison. I mean, if you've seen the poison that they pump on these things, I've worked on farms. I live near a Christmas tree farm, and if you saw the stuff they spray on that, you would not have a Christmas tree in your house. My neighbor said he used to have, you can see the trout swimming in the stream here until they opened that Christmas tree farm, and now you don't see any. So it's serious, all this stuff they're dumping. And I know when something grows in my garden, I know there's nothing on it. And if a worm eats it, if a worm won't eat it, why would I eat it? That's how I look at it. If something's too perfect, and a lot of the stuff that loses its taste, like the cantaloupes and things in the stores, it's like, there's no point. It's not even food to me anymore.
You get,
and that's not really paranoia. That's like that's real. If you're spraying poison on something, it's causing a ripple. You're putting it right in your body, not to mention the ripple effect of killing the bees or the beneficial insects and on down the chain. So again, long term effects that we, in our short sightedness, just kind of brush off for convenience and profit.
Well, there was it was a big news story here in Cleveland not too long ago, maybe a month or so ago, when they had the big algae bloom towards the west end of the lake near Toledo. And I was watching all the news coverage, and almost every news outlet totally skipped over the underpinning reason as to why that happened. And it was agricultural runoff. And yet nobody was talking about that. And I just thought that was really, if our heads are in the sand, or I don't know. It just was really troubling to me that we were talking about this toxic algae bloom and no one wanted to talk about why it was there.
It's too big to solve.
I think with any market, even the organic stuff, there's going to be people who come in and try to make a quick buck, and I'm sure there's organic stuff that's sold out there that has maybe the organic label on it, but it really isn't. Or, there's a lot of medicine and stuff or weight loss stuff that's just kind of scammy crap to make a bunch of money really quick, so.
I don't trust anything labeled organic in the store, because all that is a sticker to me. But out here, I know what's on it. So that's my standard. That's my bar that I go by.
Do you raise your own pigs?
No, we're not.
I know you like bacon.
We've got chickens, but and we've killed, we just got a cow from our neighbor a couple of years ago that had an injury, so it was going to get killed. So he couldn't eat it, so he's too attached to it. So we took it off his hands, and we just now finished that. So, and I used to be a hunter, and I'm going to get back into it and stuff. We've got chickens, but we don't kill them. So I'm kind of one of these. I think being honest with your food is really important. Ideally, I wouldn't want to eat meat, but yeah, bacon's pretty darn good.
It always worries me when you go to the store and you see that, like, no fat bacon and stuff. Like, what is that? That's not bacon if there's no fat, because bacon's like pretty much just fat.
Well, something that's also kind of in the news right now, and I was like, wow, this couldn't have been more perfect timing. We're in the process of, or very soon to be hit by a big solar flare, and I saw you even on Facebook today. You made a joke about the zap heads. I wonder if you could maybe for readers or listeners that aren't familiar with the After series, if you could maybe give us a quick explanation of what that's about and why that's kind of relevant right now.
Well, my apocalypse is triggered by a solar storm, and it shoots radiation. The sun's ejecting this radiation when it has these explosions and flares. And it's just a question of if, not when, not if, we get hit by one of these. You know, scientists say it's likely within the next 20 years we'll be hit with the massive one. The only couple of ones, the biggest one to hit the Earth was in the 1870s when all we had was telegraphs and it was burning out telegraph lines. So if you can imagine what a storm of that size would do with our current electrical grid. So I don't know, you know, I kind of made up all the science about, you know, changing our electromagnetic functioning of our brains, but, you know, we are just wiring, so I just took some liberty there and made some mutants and with a lot of death. And some of the things I use in the book would not really happen. It's similar to the electromagnetic pulse from a nuclear weapon, or in this case, thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons at the same time. So it could be pretty devastating. And they say this weekend, you know, we may lose our transmission right in the middle of it. But so far, so good. So don't take away my Facebook.
did you do any kind of research on solar flares, or did you sort of just take a telling angle and just kind of formulate what you thought could happen?
Yeah, I did quite a bit, mostly because of with other interests of, like, I don't want to say wacko survivalist thinking, but just what is the reality? You know, we worry about these asteroids hitting the Earth, and that's probably going to happen. I don't know if the human race will still be around at that time, but that's going to happen sometime just because of all this stuff flying around. And the universe has forever, you know, to have these collisions. And just the sun is a ticking time bomb. It's a, you know, it's a nuclear reaction constantly. It's not that far away. And we're pretty fragile. We don't like to admit it, but so I did a bit of research. There was actually a study in 2008 the government commissioned a study, and they basically just, like with the algae bloom, they threw up their hands and said, this problem's so big, all we can do is just hope it doesn't happen. Because if it melts the electrical grid, you can't make the parts to rebuild transformers to rebuild the one I linked to on my Facebook page. They said it cost $1 to $2 trillion to replace our infrastructure, and up to a year of us living without power. Imagine what that would be like. So, yeah, it's kind of fun to think about that. I was just telling my wife, I've got enough food canned. We can probably make it till December or January if we have to. We live near fresh water, so we could probably make it. But, again, then winter hits, and where are you? No delivery trucks, no food in the grocery stores.
Was there one that hit in Canada in the 80s?
Yeah, there was one that had some localized power outages, I think, in Toronto. And that was pretty small. But also, you know, satellites could be knocked out. Astronauts would be exposed to radiation. The shield around the Earth that supposedly would protect us from that kind of radiation. Again, it depends on the level of severity.
So does it,
scary stuff, but no scarier than what we already do to ourselves on a daily basis. So
it's the idea that this electromagnetic force would just overload the grid and fry everything that's connected. So let's say your phone is off, and then you turn it back on after the pulse. Are you okay then? Is your phone you're back on Facebook at that point?
No, it fries everything. And it melts the circuits. A lot of the cars wouldn't work. Now, the Russians did some testing with the it's the same with nuclear weapons. And there have been government tests with the Army will put the vehicles within a certain range to see if they'd still function after an explosion, except for the one I read that the Army did. They had to give the vehicles back in functioning order after the test, so they didn't really put them close enough to really test them. They had to make sure that they worked. But the Russians did one where it wiped out everything, you know, nothing would work. So they say the older cars without the, I'm not a mechanic, but the solenoid or some electronic ignitions and things, those would still work. Like 60s, 70s cars would still work, supposedly.
Wow.
Yeah, anything with electronics is dead.
Yeah, the EMP genre is really popular right now.
It's, you know, it's, we're kind of all sleeping under the bomb, and it kind of goes away and comes back. And the reality is, well, that's the other thing. And later on in my series, which I'm starting to get into, is the other side effect is if our power's out, we've got 4,000 nuclear power plants that are going to be melting down with no way to stop them. You think Fukushima times 4,000, really. And that one, at least we could, you know, try and do something about. But if you don't have backup generators, these things are just melting at will. So, yeah, it could be pretty scary pretty fast.
Wow. And you have, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the character's name, but the old prepper in your series. Didn't he have a lead box, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, there's Faraday cages that you can store stuff in that protects. Got to be completely enclosed and shielded, and so that nothing can get in. So if you have some of those, and you can make them pretty simply, apparently, but you know, it makes you wonder, why have we not built these for our electrical grids? You know, the power stations should have some kind of backups. Power plants, nuclear plants should have them. But they're too expensive. That's the problem. It's kind of what the study said. Yeah, we could deal with this, but yeah, I mean, we couldn't spend money on anything else for 20 years. It's too big to solve.
Yeah. Wow. So the piece about I kind of agree with you, though. I think it's foolish to think that no matter what is being said in the media, that some type of force of that magnitude doesn't have some effect on our brain. Did you find any sort of like...
Maybe just your brain.
My brain, yeah. But I'm going to wear a lead hat, so I'll be fine.
Like a Magneto, like...
Yeah, like the old tinfoil hat, right? I'm going back to the
future. Old school.
Yeah.
Well, Scott sells those right from his website, don't you, Scott?
Yeah. I think it's too late for me, though. If you sell tinfoil hats, it's already too late.
You could sign them. They could be autographed tinfoil hats from Scott Nicholson.
They could be like, come with one of your books or something.
It's like the L. Ron Hubbard has some books etched in titanium that you can buy for like designed to withstand a nuclear attack, and they're like $20,000 a page or something.
Because that's what you're going to read.
There actually has been some research with the cell phone and the people living near those electrical transformers or power relay stations and stuff, that they may be causing some kind of damage or cancer, or we just don't know the effects. It's never really been tested enough because, of course, the people, you know, if anybody suspects that this is a threat, there are usually powerful people who, I'm not putting on my tinfoil hat here, but it's like, again, people don't really want to know. So who's going to fund a study to prove that there's going to have to be a costly solution implemented? We can't even put scrubbers on our coal-fired power plants to clean the air. So, and we still live in a world where half of the people don't believe that global warming is possible, much less that it's actually going on. So how can you actually get a consensus around something that's kind of you can't see, and it's very difficult to prove? So I don't personally believe it.
History. You're
standing here with a cell phone to your ear all day. It's probably doing something.
Yeah, I mean, if you put it next to like a speaker, it buzzes. Like it makes my alarm clock buzz. Like, there are studies in, I think it was Norway, looking at Wi-Fi broadcasters, Wi-Fi, and the effect that was having on plants and trees. And I think we all know at our core that there's probably some damage being done, but I want my damn Facebook.
Yes, cellular. If we're in bed, my wife can tell if I left the Wi-Fi on. I know other people that can walk into a house and immediately tell if it's on. So,
yeah,
that's strange.
Something.
But you raised an interesting point. I'm sorry, Richard. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, when you talked about cell phones, I was thinking of that Stephen King book.
Cell.
You have one where it was like cell, or it was like made people go crazy.
Yeah. Yep. But we do like have this history though as a species of sort of turning a blind eye to. to the destruction we can see just on the horizon. I mean, it's, every civilization has kind of gone through that cycle where they're invincible, and then hundreds of years later, not even hundreds of years later, they're gone. And I don't know. Maybe we're on that downhill side right now.
Yeah, that's what they usually say about America. It's like we Americans will do the right thing after all other options have been exhausted. And that's what they say about global. That's actually one of the quotes of global warming. Is like, well, you say the world's going, you know, it's going to be an uninhabitable planet in 50 years. We'll get back with me in 49.
Oh, so well, you know, at least if the grid goes down, you'll still be able to play some guitar, right?
I got the guitar sitting around. Yeah,
nice segue.
I have an acoustic.
You like that?
I like that segue. Yeah.
What do you like to play?
Well, I've written a lot of songs. I used to be a musician, my first incarnation of my creative life. I was in rock bands for about 10 years, so I was writing a lot of songs, and then I got into writing. I shifted over. Now I'm getting a little back into music. I got my daughter a guitar, and that's got me back at it again, and then I realized, what's the point? You know, I can get paid for writing. I will never make money off of music, but... especially in the Spotify era. I don't know if any musicians will ever make a living in the next 20 years, you know, from now on, really. It's hard to see unless they tour 300 days a year. And writers can't go on tour, right? Nobody wants to.
I've had that conversation with many of my musicians friends. I've been in bands myself, and I just left one in the spring, and what I tell people is like I say you better really enjoy all the music that's been recorded and published up until now. You better really enjoy all that because I just don't see an incentive for aspiring musicians to make music when they're getting a tenth of a cent per play.
Mm-hmm. And well, there'll be people. They'll still need the top 50 bands. You know, they'll still be the celebrity bands. But for their your grunt musicians, working class musicians, it's going to be a tough road.
So what was your experience? Obviously, you left music to write. So was that because you felt your creativity was better expressed through writing, or was it financial, or sort of how did you make that transition?
I think it's kind of both. You know, I was just a low-level semi-pro musician, and because we were always trying to do our own songs and do our. And now I can look back and see all the things we needed to do to make it as a band. But the reality is. A band, you got four or five people, you got to show up on time, everybody's got to be all in. If you're writing, it's all you, you don't have to keep the drummer sober, you don't have to drive somewhere to play for people. You're sitting there, you can do it all from home, and that's why I'm really grateful for this digital era, because this is all I've ever wanted to do is sit at home and work and write stories and walk to the garden when I feel like it, so... You know, I used to have to do all the book signings and everything. Now I rarely leave the house, which starts making me a little paranoid. My wife makes me go out and deal with people. So she says I'll run out of stuff to write about if all I have is Facebook as my reality. So I'm starting to think she's right.
Well, Conrath just put a post up this weekend about conferences, and I know he used to do a lot of signings and stuff early on too, and he's basically has the same perspective, like there's no point in it, and it's a waste of money, and so yeah, it's kind of interesting. Richard, have you attended any sort of writer workshops or conferences or anything like that?
The only conference I go to is the Horror Writers Conference every time they have one. Mm-hmm. I'm a big proponent of the Horror Writers Association.
Yeah. You being sarcastic there, Richard?
No.
Well, I should be at the one next year.
No, I really haven't been to too many conferences at all now.
Once you get in demand and people start bugging you to go, maybe.
Yeah, like Hugh Howey, he's like all over the world.
Well, you get to design the life you want to live, right? So if you don't like to go to conferences, you don't have to anymore. Not that you ever had to. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dean Koontz does pretty well, and he hardly ever leaves his house. So.
Now, that's a great point, Scott. And you're going to ruin your sort of doomy image if you say you get to design the life you want. Because I think there are a lot of people that are a lot of authors who feel like they have there's a certain track they're supposed to be on, and there are certain things that they're supposed to do, but... I agree with you. I think this is a time for writers of really true liberation. I mean, we can basically do whatever we want, you know. Like, look at someone like Joanna Penn. Like, she wants to travel, so she goes all over the world speaking. That's not what I want to do, but that's what she wants to do, and she can construct that. And I think that's really awesome.
Yeah.
And five years from now, it's going to all come to, you know, go down the drain, and then we're all going to be screwed. Right, Scott?
Possibly. Might make it till the end of the decade.
I set you up. You're supposed to go right into the doomsday.
All right. A softball, huh? Well, okay. If musicians, look at all the musicians out there, and they're putting out music, and they're making a tenth of a penny per play. And
then you're stealing Jay's words.
Yeah. And it's probably lower than that. I've got some friends who are in a band, and they're like, it's ridiculous. And the pay varies depending on where, when, and why, or whatever. But let's just say it's less than a penny. And a musician's probably going to, if they're any good, their song's going to get played multiple times, right? Now, in what world is any of us regular writers going to have our book read multiple times by the same reader? Not this world. Stephen King, I look at some of my favorite books, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. I've only read it three times. There's probably no book I'm going to read more than three times in my life. So we only get to sell a book once for the most part. And with something like these subscription services that are the literary version of Spotify, the price is just going to go down, down, down. Just, okay, I'll just turn it back around. You guys paint me a picture of a world where we're going to make more money.
Well, I think it's a little different for music and books. I mean, like you said, people can listen to the same song. Yeah. And they want to listen to the same song over and over and over again. So it kind of makes sense that the artist is going to probably make a little less per play. Also on things like Pandora, I mean, a lot of times I may plug in a certain group that I want to listen to, but they'll play other groups that I didn't even select.
Right.
And so some groups are going to get plays even when nobody selected them and didn't ask to hear them. I mean, hasn't music always been, to me, I've always thought of it as, well, really your bread and butter is playing live. And I think people are always going to want to see bands live. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of bands, they try to do too much live. Like, they put on this huge performance where they got pyrotechnics and all this stuff, and they end up making no money because they spent it all on the show, where maybe they should just tone it back a little bit, and then they can – it might mean they have to tour a little bit more, but it's kind of part of what you ask for when you're going to be a musician, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although some of my musician friends will say that YouTube is starting to kill that, because you can basically go on YouTube and you can see – just about any band you want sitting on your couch. And so, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you waited for the band to come to your town, and then you bought a ticket, and then you went to see them. And now, like, you can pull up the video on YouTube from the front row, and I mean, it's not the same. I'm not saying it's the same at all, but I think for the casual listener, that's so much easier and more efficient than going to the show.
They say the same thing about torrents and movies and stuff. And I mean, there's a lot of musicians that think torrents are good because it helps get their music out there where other people would never hear it. And I mean, think about musicians 20 years ago. They didn't have the internet, you know, really. So they couldn't put their music. It was just dependent upon going out there and just slugging away every day at the clubs. Whereas there is a lot more ways to get your music heard now. Look at all the people on YouTube that become successful because they put their stuff on YouTube. I mean, Justin Bieber, I mean, who I don't like. I'm not, you know, advocating Justin Bieber.
Sure.
But yeah, that's how he became successful.
And so there's always more challenges, more opportunities, and, you know, every door that closes, two more open. So you can always find a way. You know, I came up through the traditional publishing of where back then we were told this is how you do it. You get your agent, you get send off and get your rejection slips. And back when I started, you could actually send straight to a publisher. You didn't even need an agent. That's how long I've been doing this. So, but the game has changed. Now there are a lot more options. So it's great in that respect. I do think the pressures that are hitting the traditional publishers are going to come to the independent writers and the whole industry. And it's great for the readers. I just see our pool is ever shrinking because it seems to me like more writers are coming in than readers, and just the competition for those eyeballs and the dollars is just, I don't see it ever easing. I see it getting worse and worse until, you know, people are getting the subscription service, and reading all they want for $2 a month, and authors are making 10 cents a book. That's my doomsday scenario.
No, but I think that's, you know, your comment on pricing, I think, is really key to this whole thing. Like, I don't necessarily think the subscription model itself is going to be bad for authors, because people don't consume books in the same way that they do movies and music. Right. It's very different. The pace is different. However, if in an attempt to squash the competition, someone like Amazon starts dropping the KU monthly charge to $2 a month, then yeah, mm-hmm. clearly that's going to cut from the author's royalties, no doubt. But if it's enough of a pinch, and I think now it probably is, like $10 a month, I think for most mm-hmm. people, you know, they have to really get use out of it. And I think mm-hmm. when they start and they're like, wow, I read two books this month, that's not worth $10, there might be some pushback on it. But, you know, Amazon being who they are and controlling most of the market, if they decide KU is going to be $4.99 a month, they could do that tomorrow.
Yeah, or packaging it with other things like Prime, or, you know, everybody who, you know, probably have a Christmas deal where you buy this and you get 3 months of the library. I mean, they're really pushing it hard. I've seen a lot of ads on Facebook for it, and on their own Amazon.com, they're pushing it really hard. So that I feel like they're all in. A lot. I've heard people say they think, okay, if it doesn't work, they're going to back off. I don't see them ever backing off. I see them, you know, right now, most people, you know, like Scribd and Oyster have the more of the traditional books, and I think that's the thing that would draw more people in if they could get any book they wanted rather than just some books. So, yeah, I think Richard's right to a degree but the other thing is not just that library, it's everything. It's the pricing pressures have gone down just in the few years it's been hot. You know, the bestsellers all used to be $9.99, and now the average price, you know, if you follow it, they're $4 to $5, $6 is kind of the average price. So you know, the independent prices are still around the same, but that's just because Amazon gives you more money if you put your book at $2.99. So that's sort of become a standard $2.99, $3.99, $4.99 range is where most people are pricing their books. So that has become the de facto price, you know. So the pricing pressures, I just see ever downward. I don't see any way to reverse that trend and make books more valuable in the digital age.
It does feel to me a little bit like over the last year or so that a lot of authors have been pricing their books a little higher. Mm-hmm. It used to be, you know, we went for a year or two there where it was free and 99 cents was like, you had to have it 99 cents. But now, like, $2.99 became sort of the, like you said, the standard. But now I see a lot of people, $3.99, $4.99 is becoming where they're going, especially if they've already developed an audience. Mm-hmm. And the audience is willing to pay that. Right. I mean, I know that my readers are willing to pay the $3.99 for my mm-hmm. series. And I'm sure your after readers are as well. So mm-hmm. I think it's just about establishing, you know, a reader base. Maybe you got to be a little cheaper at first, but once you get the reader base, you can charge a little bit more and people mm-hmm. are willing to pay it.
I think that's the key too, though. I don't think you can come out of the gate as a new writer with no catalog and right. expect to get $4.99 for a book. Like, that's not going to happen. But it
just depends on you know, the genre, you know. Mm-hmm. But there are some genres that yeah, you can come out with nothing. Like the EMP thing, those guys come out of nowhere with just one book, and they're $3.99, $4.99, $5.99, and they're selling. Because it's just the people who read those books, man, they go buy everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, are you seeing a bump in the books you have in KU? Are you seeing a bump in those and sort of your other books related to it, ranking-wise? Like, are you seeing any benefit for being in it?
Well, I started moving some more books back in to Kindle just because of I wanted to see, and it looks like a wash to me. Like, I'm getting as many borrows as I'm losing in sales, but Amazon's set up this wonderful system where it's kind of feeding, rewarding those books that are in it. So
I said that last week on the show, where it seemed to be that if your book is actually gaining more of a rank for a borrow now than it does for a regular sale.
Yeah, and it looks so. It's beneficial, depending on how heavily dependent you are on Amazon for your readers. Most of us, you know, that's 3/4 or more of our readers come from there. So And if the system's going to reward you for being in there and people can check out your books, then there are a lot more advantages to it. And so, yeah, I hate going back and forth and back and forth, and it's the exclusivity is really hard on your fan base. You know, it's hard to apologize if we're your books. So, well, I have to make a living. So,
well, like your after series, you probably don't have that one in Select, right?
No, a series is easy to put everywhere, and yeah. I think it's more advantageous.
And then if you stop doing it, then you're really going to have people be angry because where's book four? You know, like you've already got them to read the first three, and if you kind of feel bad then if you just pull out on them.
Yeah, I've been all in like 2012 in the free book era. I was gung ho about all that. I gave away over 1 million books, and
I think I got about 30 of them. I think I bought one or two of your books, but like seriously, the rest of them I got for free because I know you were going crazy in like 2011, 12 or whatever.
Yeah, and so I still don't know if that helped me or hurt me. It helped me in the short term, but you know, back then I was only thinking short term. Now I'm trying to think a little longer term, but it's about keeping the readers, and I understand the readers have so many choices. You know, if they loaded up 250 free books in 2012, they may get around to mine eventually and like it, and then go on to read the rest of my stuff. So those are long-term seeds that are planted along the way. And I remember back in the 90s when I first started, if there was a way that you could give away that many books, people would have been loving it. Writers would have said, great, I want readers, you know. Especially if you're nowhere, you're just starting out. So yeah, I think it's great for everybody. It's just, it's a golden goose that I just don't see lasting for a writer income. I think everything else is going to still work.
Have you considered selling directly to your audience from your website?
I have actually sold some PDFs and things, but just the maintenance of it and setting it all up, it's just so much easier to go here and buy it, and I'm fine with that. If it was a $99 product and I was giving away $50 with every sale to a distributor, it would be one thing, but you know, giving a distributor a third of the money doesn't seem unreasonable to me.
Yeah, I'm really on the fence with that, and I want to do it, but I think I'm hesitant because anytime I try and send like my mother-in-law a book, it turns into a 45-minute conversation.
Right.
You know, and I worry like even if it's a PDF, trying to get the customer to get that PDF to their device could just be like a support nightmare. And I don't want to get into the business of providing IT support for my readers.
Right. And the other thing is
go ahead.
Well, you're losing your algorithmic benefit of being in the store and the visibility, and you're kind of swimming uphill, and you get the challenge of, how are you going to get the readers to your website? I'd rather them find me on Amazon than try and find me out there in the internet universe. So,
yeah, Richard, you were going to comment on that too.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You know, it's nice to get the extra 30% or whatever, and if you have a dedicated enough audience, it'll go to your website. But at the same time, by being on Amazon and getting them to go there, every sale you get there increases your ranking, which increases your visibility, which will then increase your audience. Mm-hmm. Right.
So, well, I look at it this way. Who would be the most prime person you think could pull it off? You'd think like Harry Potter, right? And they did. They had Pottermore, where they were controlling their own sales and had all the ebook rights. And what did they do? They ended up giving them to Amazon because they didn't want to deal with them. So if Harry Potter can't pull it off, I don't see how I can.
I could see if I was that big of a seller, maybe I would try it at first just to get those initial sales, and then do what they did, you know, eventually go everywhere. But
James Patterson should do it since he hates Amazon so much.
He doesn't even write his own books anymore, does he? See, he's got like a new book every week.
Yeah, he doesn't write them, and he's certainly not going to sell them on his own. So,
love his little TV commercials. Like, we know you didn't write that book.
Scott, I definitely wanted to ask you about professional associations. It's something Richard and I have talked about before, and I was wondering if you could sort of tell us your experience as a member of the Horror Writers Association and how that's been and what benefits you've gotten out of that or not. I'm just kind of curious.
Well, I was. It was really great in the early days to have something to work for, and that the goal of being accepted into a professional writer organization is like, okay, I had to have 3 pro story sales at that time, and when I got that 3rd one, it was like, woohoo, I'm somebody. And then I became an officer. I might have been vice president or something, but for a couple of years, and headed up the publications committee, and we actually got the anthologies rolling again, which had been dead for 10 or 15 years, and actually put one out, and we're trying to started a series, a vampire series, and I think they've done 3 books now. And then after that, I left. I just got kind of, and I've been in mystery writers. I was an officer in the regional chapter, and volunteered with international thriller writers, and I just got to the point where personally it seemed like, well, I don't want to knock on anybody. It was just a personal decision to be more iced, you know, just, okay, I've got what I can get out of it, and I've also given back what I feel like I've given back more than I've given back my share, and time to move on. That's really how I feel about it.
Yeah, fair enough. Do you think there's a value for, you know, Richard knows where I'm going with this.
Jay just joined so he could be validated.
Yeah, I'm very insecure and I needed the validation. So as soon as they accepted self-published authors, I joined.
The first day,
yeah. But like, you know, for newer writers or writers that don't, who don't have a long history, would you recommend that they be part of a professional organization?
Well, I absolutely think everybody should shoot for a year in any whatever field they're working in, science fiction, fantasy writers, or whatever, and just see if you like it, you know. Mm-hmm. And you get what you put in. I know that's a corny cliche, but, you know, if you just send in your money and you sit back waiting for something to happen, you're probably not going to get much.
The Jay Thorne approach.
I've been waiting for the Bram Stoker Award invitation, and I haven't seen it yet, so I guess it's not coming.
But I really pushed for self-publishing when I was on the board. I was like, what's the difference? If we're going to call a pro, what other definition can you use besides money? And if they can make more money than these, you know, they were like, if you made $2,000 advance on a novel, you were considered a pro. It's like, okay, if you can make $2,000 self-publishing, money's unemotional. It's a fact. It's not, it's not subjective. So, but, you know, and look at some of the publishers that they were endorsing back then. You know, a lot of them turned out to be crooks. So, there's no good way to do it besides the money level, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. I'm pretty comfortable with that very objective qualification. Like you said, it's not a contest where it's a judge and it's political. You know, it's basically like, yeah, if you can prove that you moved this many books or that you made this much money, then why shouldn't you be considered? Mm-hmm. It's really not about an agent or a publisher. It should be about whether or not people will pony up to read your stuff.
Yeah, and also it could be that a fear that the self-publishers would end up taking over because they're the only ones making money anymore.
Yeah, like, it's, what is it, 2,000 in 2 years?
It's, 2,000 in the first 24 months of a new book. Yeah.
I mean, I know horror is a difficult market, but I'm sure most self-published horror authors are probably doing that in 2 years.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, man. The stats are that the average self-published book sells 4 copies in its lifetime.
I'm talking about, like, serious people.
Okay.
And I'm not talking about the person who just puts that old novel that, you know, they found in the trunk and they just throw it up there because they think they're going to get rich. I'm talking about somebody who's seriously doing it as a career and mm-hmm. who's always writing new stuff every day. And that's the only person I think that's going to try to be in an association anyway. Mm-hmm. The person who just has one novel, they're not going to go join an association.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, true.
Or maybe I just sell so well that I'm just off in my, like, I'm off in, like, planet, you know.
You're like, 2,000.
I'm like, 2,000. I mean, that's like, yeah, I do that, like, you know, every day pretty much.
Buy the organization.
Yeah, exactly.
You can buy a Stoker.
Yeah, I didn't have any problem. Well, I mean, maybe that's the way you get Stokers. I don't know. But I didn't have any problem with the organization. I used to be a member probably 10 or 11 years ago. Just I think it was like an affiliate or something. It wasn't like I wasn't an active member. It was just like a, hey, we're being nice and we'll let you be a member because we want your due money. You know, I didn't really have many publishing credits or anything, so I didn't fit the active member role. But it wasn't that I don't have any problem with it. It was just I feel like if I'm going to pay money to be in something, I should be getting some value out of it. And I'm not sure what value they can offer me at this point into self-publishing, because they were always based around traditional publishing and most of the authors in there were traditionally published. And with the way the internet is and the Facebook and what we're doing right now, you know, we can communicate with authors really easily and network and stuff. So I didn't know if there was any point in really being in associations like that anymore.
Well, the only real value to an organization is marketing to me. I mean, if you can't market your writers and as a nonprofit, there are all these shady gray areas of what you can and can't do. And to me, I want people to sell my book. You know, I want to be able to market books. you know, if I join a group, it's going to be a marketing group. And, you know, International Thriller Writers does it a little bit. They have a newsletter and make sure and they promote the newsletter and it features books by the members, their new releases and stuff. So that's pretty useful. But it's not like and it's actually dues free at the moment because they use their anthologies to fund the organization. Of course, they've got some huge names, so it's a little easier for them to make money, but. Marketing's the hardest part of this whole gig.
Yeah, it's probably easier to sell thrillers than just horror novels at this point in time, anyways.
Mm-hmm. But,
well,
every
I feel like
point.
We're I feel like we're coming up here on an hour. Maybe we can kind of wrap some things up. So, Scott, do you want to tell our listeners and our audience where they can find you and best places to go?
My website's authorscottnicholson.com, and on Facebook I'm Author Scott Nicholson as well, so pretty easy to find. Just plug Scott Nicholson into your little browser window and you'll get more of me than you can stand, I'm sure.
We'll make sure we have those links in the show notes for everyone that's listening and not necessarily writing things down.
Well, we didn't get to the most important question, though. What does Scott think of me having his picture back there on the wall?
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. That's how I tell everybody how to spell my name. It's like Jack Nicholson, only Scott.
Oh, yeah, that's Scott Nicholson, right?
I think we're related and our noses are kind of the same.
Oh, I was confused.
You got the wrong picture up there.
I thought we were talking to, yeah. Oh,
well,
I feel like an idiot.
I wanted to just close with a few quick comments to Scott, if that's all right.
Yeah.
I'd like to start by saying, no, seriously, Scott, it's been really great getting to talk with you. Like I said, we've been kind of working together for a while now, and this is the first time we've got to talk face-to-face, and I really enjoyed it and really appreciate you coming on our podcast.
Well, thank you. It's cool to be in box sets with you guys, so.
Yeah, and let's see, we're in the N3 together, right, Richard? That's the one we're
all
in?
That's it. I know, so, you're in so many, you probably forget.
Yeah, more than
Scott's
I should be.
Scott's probably got you beat, maybe.
No,
Scott's been in a bunch, too.
Yeah, just a couple. I do claim credit for being the first person to do that. I did it at the beginning of 2012. And
there you go.
Joe Conrad and Crouch and some guys. And I don't know why I didn't keep going. I wish I had, because nobody was doing it back then. Now everybody.
Yeah, now it's kind of playing out, but we're on the tail end of that, but that's okay.
Yeah. It'll be a next thing.
Yeah.
Despite my doomsday stance, I'm actually an optimist. I think there's always going to be an opportunity. So for those who keep at it.
That's the key. You got to keep at it. If you think it's like hitting the lottery, you're better off playing the lottery.
Yeah.
Any closing comments here, Richard, besides what's on your back wall?
Oh, yeah. Hold on here.
We really need you to like and review us because we need validated.
What?
What are you playing? Are you playing me back? It's like an old radio gag, right?
What are you talking about?
It's an old radio gag, like hit the play button. Yeah, hopefully you'll listeners will go over and like Richard's trying to make the joke that we need validation.
Like, review us because we need validated.
Yeah, we need to be validated.
We need to be validated. We're not going to feel like a success until you tell us you like us. So like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, leave an iTunes review. Otherwise, we're going to go cry in a corner.
Aww.
All right. Well, that's it for episode 10. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in. Thanks again to Scott for being on the show, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for tuning in to the Horror Writers Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Do it. Do it now. What are you waiting for? Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter.